I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our guest this week, Dawn Cook Ronigan, author of Antique American Needlework Tools. Dawn, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, this is going to be a fun one. I've been pouring through this book. I'd like to say I've read every word, but I haven't. But oh, have I spent some time. This is fun, yeah. So for those who don't know Dawn, she's a historian, as you'll learn, a needleworker, and then you'll also learn a longtime collector of sewing and embroidery tools. When you get the book, you'll discover that she owns just about everything that's in the books. So she is a collector. And so what we get to learn about is her stitching, and then we get to learn about this book and all of the fascinating antique tools that are in here, soup to nuts when it comes to needle and thread things. This is fun. But first let's learn a little bit about you, your needlework. When did you start? What do you stitch? What are your interests?
Well, I started stitching. My earliest memory is around first grade. My grandmother purchased a hoop, some floss, and a dresser scarf at a dime store. And that kind of started my love for embroidery. But I was just as fascinated by the hoop and the thread and the scissors and all the goodies that was in my little sewing box. So that probably started the whole thing. As far as the types of needlework I like to do, I like to try it all. I've done Hardanger, counter cross stitch, crewel. I'm a hand quilter, hand applique quilting. I recently did a project for the American Quilt Study Group that's traveling around the country. And it's a quilt that incorporates Schwalmen dressed in embroidery with a fringed edge. So I like to try things that are challenge to me personally.
Oh, I admire that. That's my kind of deal. Now, you just said a word I've never heard, Dresden embroidery?
Yeah, the Schwalmen Dresden embroidery is a type of white work that's often done on linen, and it's unusual to find them in these bed coverings. So I was able to combine my love of quilting and my love of embroidery into one project for this study. Enter it into their study program.
Yeah, now see, I know Schwalm, but I don't know Dresden. Just a variation of that or same name for different things?
Yeah, they are. And in my research, I think it's sometimes hard to recognize or distinguish between the two. Mm. So I use both terms so that if a subject matter expert beyond my knowledge knows, I've taken a little liberty there. It was a piece that I own that is estimated to be around 1790 to 1800. Mm. And I reproduced it into a piece. I think it's about 40 inches square. I haven't seen it for a few years. These projects travel for 4 years. I think it's about 40 inches square. Mm. And it's all complete, 100% hand-stitched.
Well, that's going to be impressive when it gets finished. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all white. So I hope it comes home not looking like a like a dust cloth, but I think it'll be fine.
Yeah, that was my first thought. I hope it comes home white.
I have great confidence.
Yeah. Yeah, that's but yeah, just the traveling alone. Count on people to wrap it up clean. Yep. Well, I got to explore Dresden now because, yeah, the Schwalm, was it Luzine Hoppel? I follow her. She does, uh-huh. I think she does Schwalm. That's her, yeah, her deal. And, but I'd never heard the Dresden, so I got to do some learning there. Mm-hmm. Yep. So you've been stitching, you stitch right along. You started from first grade and have never given it up, but the side hustle is the tools.
I had periods of time, you know, raising children and working full time when I had, you know, less time than others, but I also traveled quite a bit and loved to take stitching along with me. When I traveled, you know, I was the geek in the hotel room stitching. I wasn't at the bar socializing.
Yep.
I've always probably been most comfortable with a needle in my hand. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah. No, I know that. And I also know that period of time where you're raising kids and, you know, there might be a little time once a week, but other than that, no, it sits in a basket.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, waiting in the car for the next pickup time or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that's one thing that's always was a frustration when I, now it is for me when I was raising kids, is I think back of all the hours sitting in cars or sitting in lobbies or whatever waiting for the kids. I could have been stitching. It just never occurred to me. And yeah, I wasted a bunch of time there. Yep.
I look at projects and I think, oh, that's the project I did when we were selling the house in California. And I would spend a couple hours a day in the car in between showings.
Yep. See, that's where I missed out. Yeah. So when did you probably just gradually eased into collecting all of these tools, I would guess, all these little pieces.
Yeah, it was a gradual slide, I think.
Slide. Okay.
And actually, I am trying harder to resist, and my husband's very supportive of what I do, and so is my family. And I'm usually the one that says no, and they're like, "Oh, but you'll regret it." So I blame them partially, but I just always have been fascinated with what beauty you can make with the simplest of tools. Now that said, some of the tools are quite elaborate and fun to collect, but
Yeah.
I just find it fascinating.
So then, are you constantly on the hunt? I mean, I got to believe you're going to antique stores a lot, but are you also just keeping your eyes open for people who might have something and really don't care about it, but it means something to you? How do you acquire these kinds of things? Because this isn't something you just trip over all the time.
That's probably the most frequent question I get asked. And I always like to say everywhere is an opportunity. So we both love to scour antique shops and flea markets and antique shows, which has been hard in this time of COVID.
Right.
But we have been doing auctions. Even our local auction house is doing online auctions now. And I managed to do a little damage there this week and picked up some new things. And usually it's funny that it would make a great picture because I got some fabulous things, but it was thrown in with a box lot, with a worn out metal griddle, an antifreeze tester, and a bunch of other things that have no relationship to stitching, and you had to expand the picture and really kind of look and see what was in there. But it's fun, yeah.
That's the thing about all these tools is they're small items. So it's like you must just a lot of time peering into glass cases and like you said, looking at pictures for the small pieces.
Yeah, and I have been able to acquire some of the things in the book that were with private collectors, who are retiring, and most people want their items to go to a good home, someone who's gonna treasure them. And it's a little easier to part with them when they're not going to an auction and going to strangers. So, I've been happy to give some of those things new homes.
Yeah.
And it's special for me because I have memories of looking at the item with them and having them tell me about it and continuing to show it to people and use it to teach.
Right. Now, going through the book, you obviously have a vast collection. And so I start to think, all right, this is clearly the tip of the iceberg because it's the best of the best to make it into the book. So then I'm thinking, all right, does she have an entire room? Is it a barn? Is it a warehouse that you store your collection? How do you, because you must keep track of it all and keep it somewhat organized, I'd think.
Yeah, I like to think I'm pretty organized. Doing the book, of course, I had to catalog everything and plan kind of how I was going to use it. So it's all in a database. But sewing items are small, so they're a little easier to collect. I live in the Midwest, so I have the luxury of a larger home, and I have probably about 1,500 square feet. That is my office, studio space. I have what my family fondly calls my storage vault. And then I rotate things out to display them and enjoy what I have. But the house was built for an exercise room, so it's climate controlled. this vault room is climate controlled. It has no windows, so there's no natural light. And it has a separate thermostat. So instead of equipping it with exercise equipment, I have racks of storage and acid-free boxes and shelving. It'd probably be better for me if it was exercise equipment, but I have way more fun.
Well, all right. So that helps me understand, because several of the items clearly need to be in climate controlled environments or they would deteriorate rather rapidly. So you really have within your home almost the ideal setup.
Yeah, that was the goal when we were moving around for a while with my husband's work, and I was kind of the trailing spouse. And I spent that time, you know, each house kind of had its benefits. All of the photography was done in Colorado, and that house, I had a dark room that wasn't finished, but I could set up the lighting and not have to adjust it every day when the windows changed light. Mm-hmm. So that was ideal for that setting. So yeah, it's all just kind of worked out.
That's great. All right. So let's talk about where does the idea to do a book come from? Family push you into it, your own idea. How does that get started? Cause that's a huge undertaking. This is 240 pages. So this is not some little pamphlet.
Yeah. Well, I have a friend who had written a book, Anne Hermes. Her book is on Patchwork Pennsylvania Pillowcases with the same publisher. And she was very encouraging when I did the proposal, but then also when I was working through the process. And I guess I had always had it in the back of my mind to do it. And people said, just do it. You know, what are you waiting for? So, and I had seen a quote in another book where someone said that American things were very brown and predictable or kind of boring. And so that kind of threw the gauntlet down too, to challenge me to show how beautiful the American examples really are.
Yeah. And because that was one of the things early on in the reading, it's probably in your intro there, was you kind of make a point that American stuff is American items. I shouldn't call them stuff. They're better than that. Are not as common. Is that, do I read that correctly? That if you want a bunch of items from Europe, they're a little easier to get a hold of. How does that play, and why just go with American? Was it just because they're not as common?
I think, well, part of it was there's already some great books on, you know, Dutch silver and Dutch gold and some of the English pieces. And those books tended to focus on what I would consider to be more high-end pieces that we don't see here. And we, for the most part, collectors, if they have them, have really invested highly in owning them. Mm-hmm. And American things are very attainable. They're right here in our backyard, and I really find folk art interesting. Not that all of it's folk art, but it can be kind of a cross collectible too, because there's people who love American advertising. There's people who like American silver. So I tried to just focus on the American aspects.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's go back to the book itself. So you decide, all right, I'm going to do a book. Take us through the process of that. You obviously have to do a proposal. You have to find a publisher who's willing to put it together for you. So an outline, a synopsis, do you write the text first, or do you say, all right, if I'm going to do a book, I better go to my collection and figure out what's going to be in the book? Take us through that process.
Well, in acquiring things for my collection, I would want to learn about them. It's apparent to me that there wasn't a lot published that went into much detail about what I had. So I knew there was a gap there. If I bought a French Royal Palais 18 karat piece in ivory, I knew exactly what book to go to find it. But if I had a piece of folk art or something with an American patent, I had to do more of the research myself. So I was doing research anyway, just to support my collection. So then I organized it by chapter and wrote my proposal and started talking with the publisher. I had always admired this Schiffer Publishing because of the quality of their books and their willingness to combine the content as well as the photos. And that both were important to me. I didn't want it to be just a picture book, and I didn't want it to be just like a textbook with limited photography. So they kind of fill that niche market for me.
A proposal and then modifications back and forth, or were they pretty happy with what you'd put together?
They were pretty happy with what I had done. There's a few things that there are open to discussion, but at the end of the day, contractually, the final call is theirs. Mm-hmm. But it worked really fine. I can't think of any, you know, the sticking points we had. Yeah. There wasn't much for rework. It was really a fun project to do. You know, I think once the book was done and ready for market, they decide when to launch it. And so I had visions of them sitting around a conference room saying, well, should we do the antique needlework tools this quarter, or should we do the one on modern American tattoos? And so mine didn't come out right when it was ready. It took a little bit of time for them to decide to release it.
Yeah. All right. Now the tough part, I got to believe the tough part was deciding what items are going to be photographed for the book.
Oh yeah, it was really hard, and that's why you'll see some things grouped together when I would have rather wanted them to do individual photos. And the other thing is, when you do your manuscript, you're suggesting photo size and page layout and writing the captions. And so the other choice I had to go back and make was to do fewer full size photos. To stay within the price point that I wanted the book to be at.
Yeah, you mentioned that beforehand, that you were focused on not having it be a book that people had to lay out a lot of money for. You wanted it to be affordable so more people could have it.
Yeah, I in my little fantasy world, it was a lovely hard-covered coffee table book that was $75, but I knew that didn't meet the goal of getting it out to more people, and I wanted it to be affordable and available to as many people as I could. So it was my choice to do a paper cover book and to limit the pages to under 300. And some of those decisions were made early on in my discussions with them. And, you know, they interview you and talk to you about your vision for the book and kind of how you envision it would be used and what your customer demographic is like. And so we worked all those decisions out, and most of them out in the front end of the project.
Well, see, and that's terrific, because these small niche hobby books oftentimes are so expensive. Just by the nature of them, just so expensive, and to make it so people could afford to own one without dipping into the monthly food budget is a real plus, because I know I've enjoyed going through this thing and I learned so much already out of it, and I'm still not done with it, and so to put that in as many hands as possible is a real plus. So I applaud you for that. That's great.
Yeah, it's been really rewarding, too, to hear from people who got their first copy and then came back and got one for everyone in their sewing group, because they just loved it so much. And so to hear about it used as a birthday gift or a holiday gift is really, really meets my goal.
Right. No, that's great. So you're in Colorado and you got to photograph all these things. You got to set up your own little studio, I assume.
Yeah. And then in the middle of it, you decide it's time to move. You know, Mr. has a relocation and you have a project plan to stick with. And we made all that work. So yeah, it was a fun adventure.
Now, these days, everybody has a camera in their pocket. How were you able to, were you a digital SLR? I mean, were you doing a full camera thing, or were you able to do it without a lot of expensive equipment?
The full camera thing, because publishers want, well, every publisher's different. I can only speak to the requirements for my book and my project. And, you know, that can change. So, I'm only specifically for me, I did use, SLR. I do have a macro lens for some of the close-ups, like the eye of a needle to show, extreme detail. And then depending on the size the photo is going to be printed at, the file size has to be a certain quality. So yeah, it was a lot of storage space, to keep all the pictures in. I think I ended up with around 700 color photos in the book. But I probably had about, a few thousand to pick from.
Yeah. Well, and that really was a question just for me personally, because as a magazine editor, that's a battle I fight all the time, because people will send me photos that are giant on their screen and that they've pulled off their website, and in print size, they're just postage stamps, and I can't use that. And if you're going to print something, you have to have large files with resolution and a lot of megabytes, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, and the file transfer, the FTP to, move the files when you're ready to send them to the publisher. That's a whole technology part that you wear a lot of hats in a process like this.
Yeah, that's the part when it was clear that you'd done almost all the work putting this together. I just started mentally going through all the things that either you knew or had to know and learn, because there's It hits all areas just to get material to a publisher. Yeah.
Well, I have a little bit of an IT background. So that did come in handy.
That's a huge plus. Yeah. 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 Now, did they do all the layout and design for you?
For the most part. In the text, I would indicate where I wanted the photo placed. Mm-hmm. Within the chapter and within the paragraph, and they were very good to work with on that. I think they did an excellent job with that. So yeah, I had input, but they had the final say.
Yeah, well, that's where their experience is at. So you want them to,
right? Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Take advantage of what they know in their industry. So
right, right. So let's see, what do we have? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. How many chapters? 10, 12? I can't get the page turned.
About 12.
12 chapters in this thing, covering everything that you can imagine. And you start out with needle and thread. And I thought, well, this will be a short chapter. Why would you start with that? But not at all. Wow, I learned stuff about needles and needle making I didn't even think existed. That's that was a great start. I was locked in right out of the gate with that. Especially the one that stuck out for me is paying needle makers more because they would get Pointer's disease.
Yeah. Whoa. Yeah, And you know that a needle and thread is the basis of everything we do, even today as needleworkers. But even in the clothes we wear today, it still touches our life and everything that we do.
Yeah, no, I was interested by that. And then you mentioned earlier about the advertising and marketing, and I just loved looking at all the packaging. I was impressed that you had so many pieces with packaging intact, but. All the packaging, the different designs, and then the number of things that were used for promotional purposes, an awful lot of
and
that.
Yeah, that's very specific to the American market and our marketing. And they targeted the lady of the house, knowing that in many cases, she's the one who makes the decisions on spending. And so they would target advertising to her. And then the change, once women's suffrage and women got the right to vote, the politicians even targeted the women in their needle books.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, that's most interesting. Yeah. Yeah, there's a set of voters. We better hit them where it matters to them. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
So
Get a face in their hands.
Yeah. And the other part about needles was the effort that was made to wrap them. The packaging, I mean, there's a considerable effort to package these things.
Yeah, and that's a question I've gotten a lot of feedback. People really like being able to date a package of needles by the way the packaging was designed and just looking at the variation and the types of papers used. And collecting needles is something that someone who is just getting started or someone who doesn't want to spend a lot of money on their collections, that's a great place to start.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And just going through there, you could see that's definitely collectible stuff all the way around. Yeah. That one picture you have of a low quality needle. Oh, man.
Yeah. Can you just see it shredding your thread? And you're a beginner and you're so frustrated and you just don't know how people can sew these beautiful things. And it's just something as simple as the quality of your needle.
I've seen saws smoother than that. That's terrible. Yeah. And the next chapter is pins and storage. I'll get to that in a minute. But thimbles. Thimbles, whatever, but they're like the jewelry of sewing as reading through this thing. I was amazed.
Oh, they are, and they're very collectible. There's entire groups dedicated just to thimble collecting. Thimble Collectors International, the TCI group, has an annual convention.
Oh my!
And they I know ladies who have 5,000-6,000 thimbles in their collections. So this chapter, I mean, there's entire books. This chapter just touches the highlights of the American story. But yeah, they're quite passionate collectors.
Now, see, I didn't realize that at all. But I just going through and reading that chapter, I mean, it sucked me right in. And then I was just on the verge of going to the old Google and looking to see what thimbles you can buy today. Is it a whole range?
Oh, yeah. It's so fun. I've spent the last couple of days back and forth online with a collector, and I have a collection in my possession that I'm starting to find new homes for. And I just want to buy everything I see.
Do thimbles start to have value as a collectible item like a coin or a stamp would?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, there's thimbles that, easily are over $1,000 or more. There's people who collect maybe only Cupids, and they buy gold and silver Cupid thimbles. There's no end to what you can do with these items.
And are thimbles, other than just molded plastic ones, are thimbles out of silver or gold or whatever still manufactured today as a?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. There's a couple of artists in Iowa that do sterling thimbles, thimble cages, and sewing accessories in sterling today. You can, because our hands tend to be larger, often the antique thimbles won't fit today's fingers. You're lucky if they do. But yeah, people still buy precious metal thimbles today, and they're quite beautiful. You can buy them set with diamonds. You can buy them set with stones engraved. They are just like jewelry.
Oh, that's dangerous right there. Yeah, I gotta go do some checking just to see. It just seems to me like just owning one really nice one would be fun just to have. Yeah.
Yeah, and there are some artists who take the damaged thimbles that are perforated and make necklaces and jewelry and charms for stitchers who like to show off their interest in thimbles.
Can't even imagine a convention of thimble collectors.
Oh, how fun, huh? I'm planning, I think I'm speaking at their 2022 convention. And of course, things have been kind of in an uproar with COVID and everything. Their 2020 convention was canceled. But yeah, it's a very fun group.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, and the intricacies, to me, little things like that just appeal to me. But I can imagine that the intricacies of each thimble and each thimble style, probably discussions that go on forever, just talking about the differences and the similarities and origins and so on and so forth.
Yes. Was your Cupid a 1910 mold or was your Cupid a 1907 mold?
There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another one that scissors. Now, I found that interesting in because you'd expect to have a chapter on scissors. I mean, that's just a given. But that's yet another world of designs. And I know people collect those. I mean, geez, I've got four or five myself, not antiques, but that can be a habit in a hurry.
Yes, I have heard the words, we're not buying any more scissors, but that usually doesn't work. And there are artisans who are still making scissors today, beautiful scissors. I have some that aren't usable necessarily. They're more for looks out of with mother of pearl handles. But I have some that are old vintage and antique ones I still use occasionally.
Well, that was a question I had for you. When you buy these antiques, do you clean them up? Do you sharpen them? Or is it best to just leave them as they are?
I generally leave them as they are. If it's a wooden sewing cabinet, I dust it and clean it all out and that. But I generally don't do much to them. I kind of like them as found. And the scissors often are still just as sharp. I have some that look like they were hardly ever used.
Oh.
So it depends, but for the most part, I use like a lot of the thread cabinets and things because I'm a stitcher and most of the thimbles don't fit me. So it's a mix of whether I use it or not.
And I just wondered because I'd be hesitant to do much if I had an antique scissors that I collected.
I got a gold set as a gift and I said, oh, I can't wait to try these. And I got a horrified look and it was, oh, okay. Yeah. I guess I won't be using these.
But why not? Why not?
Yeah. But I did secretly snip a little silk thread with it and they were quite lovely.
Okay. All right. See, you got your satisfaction out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now one tool I had never seen was buttonhole cutters. What a weird device.
Yeah, and you know, that's kind of one of those items that was a little bit of scope creep. They're maybe more vintage than antique, but they're just so interesting. I just took the liberty to include those. Yeah, I just think they're really, really interesting. And they come in so many different styles and different patterns. And I'm especially interested in the patents that were taken out by women because women in the 19th century had so few opportunities to do things like that.
Mm-hmm. So how do they function? Do they just slit the cloth and then you hand sew all around or how do they function?
Well, a lot of instruction books would have women cut the buttonhole first and then do the stitching around the button hole opening. And there's instructional books that show you how to lay it across your finger once it's cut to do the actual buttonhole stitch. And I just actually, because I kind of like hands-on learning, I just finished a buttonhole sampler from Piecework magazine. And it had eyelets and I think three or four different buttonholes that you could stitch to try various techniques. So that was really fun. And of course I had to get out my buttonhole cutters, scissors and give them a test snip. So yeah, that was fun.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And then the part that I found historically most interesting was the sewing rolls, the huswifes. There's some real history behind all of that.
Oh, they are. And I just love to find them when they have a letter or a note in there. So I tried to include the letters in the book so that you could read some of those stories. And they were used by men. They were made for soldiers. They were made for children. Just really, really wonderful pieces to learn about.
Now, when you find those, are they typically, do they have tools in them, or are they just the cloth or leather or whatever material?
It varies. I have been fortunate to find some that have what I believe to be original letters and some contents inside, especially the ones that are fitted, that have a carrier for the bodkin and that have the pin keeps, and to find the old coil-headed pins and things kind of in place. I have seen reproduction ones, so you have to be kind of careful with what you're purchasing. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with reproduction ones as long as you know what you're buying and what your intended use is for it.
Yeah, and that raises a question, too, is the reproductions. A wary eye all the time when buying any of these things. I mean, are there
definitely?
Yeah.
There's some really high-end reproductions. Same with repairs, and same with, you know, any collectible that you have. I'm sure they all have their intended purposes. You know, some people, if they're doing reenacting or just for personal use, they're really cool with having the reproductions, and that's great. But for collectors, if that's you want the purest antique pieces, you have to kind of read up on it and know what you're buying.
Yeah. Buyer beware, always.
Yeah.
And then I blew right by the chapter that I probably spent the most time, and that was the pins and pin keeps and thread holders. What an amazing array of devices for dealing with pins and thread.
Well, and historically, how important it was for America to try and develop, you know, early on develop those industries, because they were so essential to early life here. And to think about when pins were made one at a time, you know, it's really mind-boggling.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the ones that I really caught my eye was all of the shoe-shaped holders for pin keeps. Just what a variety. And you have a wide collection of those.
Yeah, I every page is my favorite thing, but those are kind of favorites. And you're right, the variety and just the different ways they were made. And some of them have, you know, little strawberry emeries that are smaller than my pinky fingernail. The amount of detail in them is just wonderful to study.
Yeah. Now, and again, the packaging and the advertising and the wording and the designs are just as fascinating as the devices.
Yeah. And just the ones that were given as gifts that were sentimental in their meaning. Yeah. Those are just really special. Some of them will have like little Christmas tags that say, you know, to my dearest friend, Mary, with, you know, a note. And, you know, you just kind of feel it in your heart that the recipient treasured that. And, you know, someone has kept that special for 150 years. And, you know, that's really great. We'd like to think our needlework will be treasured in the same way.
Yeah, I think we all hope that. I do. It's just sometimes I think my kids would just say, get rid of all that, you know, but it's.
Yeah, I do hear that quite a bit. And my thought on that is that, you know, I don't have a single family piece really in my collection, but I feel like I give the collection a really good home, that I treasure it, and that whoever had it before would be happy to know that I'm sharing it with people, I'm taking care of it. And the fact that we're not related is maybe of lesser importance.
Now, when you get collections that have pins in them, are the pins usually in pretty good shape, or do you tend to get a lot of just rusty wire?
It varies. I try and carefully remove anything that's rusty because it's going to further damage the fabric. For the most part, though, I buy things in pretty good condition, so I haven't really had that problem. I see it more so in some of the wooden sewing boxes where the pins were just left loose with the acidic wood and are reacting to that. And anything I would take apart, I photograph to document how it was in the item. But for the most part, I haven't had to do that.
And then you mentioned you have everything in a database, so you know exactly what you have, every item, you photograph it, the whole bit?
For the most part, I have not done a great job keeping the photo IDs together as far as, like, I know which red leather piece has the sterling clasp, for example, but I need to get a better numbering system on those. And I also don't attach any stickers or labels or things to the object. I try and put the identification on the acetate paper that it's stored with. So it varies, but I think there's always room for improvement. And there's no end to the amount of time that you can spend doing that.
Is your collection at a point where museums would want to do exhibits with it?
I have loaned a few things. And I think there's more interest out there than museums maybe acknowledge. It tends to be an afterthought, like, oh, we're going to show some samplers. Maybe we should throw some tools out there. But they don't always consult with, you know, maybe putting the right tools by the right embroidery for their exhibits. But yeah, I think that would be nice if we saw more of that.
Yeah, because I could see a collection like this being a whole museum exhibit without any trouble at all, because of the history and the different devices.
Well, and unfortunately, some of our museums are closing. There is a museum in Amsterdam that does purses and bags, but they also have a beautiful collection of European needlework tools. And I have studied that collection, and they unfortunately have now closed. So we'll see what happens with that collection. But usually they're just part of something else and not.
So they're part of something else and not a collection unto themselves?
Yeah, usually that's not the primary collecting focus of the institution. There are some historical societies that probably do a little better job, but again, they're not exhibiting just needlework. They may be exhibiting samplers, and then they'll sprinkle in a few needlework tools in there. Mm-hmm. In their examples, and their collections can be quite vast.
Hoops and darning. Okay, the hoops, I got to know about the rubber hoops, but then you brought back memories with the darning balls, because that was the first time as a kid that I learned how to do any kind of sewing, because my mother had a darning ball, and if you got holes in your socks, then she showed you how to do it, and we were responsible for sewing up the holes in our socks. So my first sewing was with a darning ball in a sock and making a lumpy mess just to close up the hole. But
that, I love hearing that, because in my research, I did find that often boys, young men were taught to do their own darning, that it was a really important skill. And if you think about job, like in the military, if you get a blister or something because your sock is darned wrong, it can be deadly if you get an infection or something. So it's interesting how important little things like darning are. Of course, now people tend to throw things away, but I think mending and darning is making a comeback. The winter issue of Piecework is called Make Do and Mend, and it's all about mending and darning and you know, reusing what we already have. So maybe it's making a comeback.
Yeah, I haven't darned a sock in decades and don't plan to start
either. Toss them out and get a new pair. But I think with knitting and all the people making hand-knitted socks. I bet they're doing some darning when those wear out.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. Well, and of course for us, I mean, there were four kids and not a lot of money. And, if anything got wore out, it was socks in terms of holes in the heels and holes in the toes. So, it was a way yeah. to cheap way to save money and not have to buy socks. It was worth it. Yeah. Yeah. But even that, you know, that the whole darning thing, I thought, oh, it was hoops and darning. I thought, well, the darning will be a couple of pages. But then once again, just a tremendous variety and collection of darning tools just for simple repair. So the darning balls were a way to for women to get patents and women to have designs. That was one way they could do it.
Yeah, all kinds of darning attachments for sewing machines, darning shapes on the darning tools themselves, darning threads were an opportunity for women being subject matter experts. They were often part of patent applications for products.
As women were able to create their own products and start their own businesses, did they actually get some traction in terms of developing businesses, or were they always kind of a side thing that they did?
A little of both, and I think it depended on where they came from. I think women in the West were a little more independent, and culturally that area, you know, they were helping on the ranch and doing all kinds of other things also, where perhaps on the East Coast, that wasn't quite the case. So I think it varied depending on the region and the product.
All right, hoops. I got to know about the hard black rubber hoops. I can't even imagine those work.
I think that could cause a little damage. I should do a fiber test with that and put some light colored linen in there and see how long it takes for it to rub off.
about 3 seconds, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we can. And that whole era was, they were also doing rubber buttons, and they didn't hold up very well in the laundry and drying. So I don't think the fascination for rubber lasted long in the sewing world.
When I saw that, I thought, no, there's just no way. It just, the only thing would be black on black. That would be it. So you have one set of rubber hoops, or do you have more?
I have just a couple, and you know, I don't think I've seen them since. I don't know how many were made, but as sure as I say that, then I hear from 10 people who have them. So yeah, I personally haven't seen much of them.
They must get really stiff with age.
The rubber hoops were not adjustable, so that probably limited their marketability also. And then I also have, since the book came out, I have a sterling hoop, which is quite tarnished and not adjustable. And you can imagine that sterling was probably just for pretty, not highly practical.
Ooh, just the silver alone for that would be worth something, I think. Yeah. But that was the adjustable hoops, then, according to what it says in the book here, they were that was something that came along later. That was quite a development then.
Yeah, and they're highly collectible right now. I know the queen hoops and some of those hoops, the stitchers today really love those, and they're reselling rather high on the secondary market now because they're so loved.
Well, this is just a fascinating book, and you know, we didn't even touch on buttons and fasteners. That's a whole different world. And
oh yeah, and handmade buttons with thread are so beautiful, and there are artists that are still making those today. And that's something on my bucket list to make some hand embroidered hand lace buttons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that alone, you talk about collecting thimbles. I got to believe collecting buttons could go on forever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's entire societies for button clubs and mm-hmm. yeah.
Because, yeah, just a little bit you show in here is pretty fascinating stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Dawn, this has been a treat. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm always looking for ways to share my collection, and I love talking about it. So it was great being here, and I appreciate it very much.
And a great book. Now, folks can get the book from you on your Etsy shop. Where else can we get the book?
Signed copies are available directly through me. It's available, I think, through any major bookseller. So it's out there. Needlework shops have it. I think Stitchville in Minnesota is carrying it, and Reproduction Fabrics is carrying it. There's quite a few places to find it.
Well, all right. So, folks, you know, pick up a copy of this book. You'll enjoy it. It's great reading, great picture looking at the whole shooting match. It's a real treat. Don, thanks again. Appreciate the time, and thanks for putting the book together, because it's an unusual one and really, really fun to read.